From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this episode, we'll visit a lab at UCLA where scientists are trying to keep up with athletes, not their running or swimming, but their doping, which gets more sophisticated by the day.
There we were, injecting banned drugs just feet from thousands of people. And, you know, one of the biggest sporting events in the world.
And we'll hear about veterans who, despite picking up some high-level skills while on duty, have a hard time landing the right job in civilian life.
It's one thing to get a job as an investment banker at JP Morgan Chase. It's quite a different thing to get a job as a greeter at Walmart.
And a chat with Sean Daly of Atmosphere, the alternative hip-hop duo, whose career aspirations have changed over his 20 years in the business.
I'm so glad I didn't end up being LL Cool J in the back of a limousine with models and stuff.
We're not lucky, but we're fortunate. I'm pretty sure of it. And all the life we wasted trying to make some bread might have been better spent trying to raise the dead.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Earlier this week, just a few miles from NPR West, I found myself standing in front of a row of stainless steel, medical-grade refrigerators.
We probably have more urine than anybody in the world.
That's Dr. Anthony Bush, director of the UCLA Olympic Analytical Laboratory. It is the biggest anti-doping lab in the world. They perform drug tests for the Olympics, the NBA, MLB, NFL, NCAA, and many others. They test over 40,000 samples each year. The place is packed with millions of dollars worth of the most cutting-edge scientific gear in existence, and more than 40 top-level scientists to go with it. There are no signs outside to mark this amazing facility. They prefer to keep it nondescript. Because they're developing the latest weapons in what many are calling a doping arms race. And that's our cover story today. When you think of doping in sports today, it's almost impossible not to think of the U.S. Postal Service team that won so many big cycling races. From 1998 to 2001, Tyler Hamilton rode on U.S. Postal. He says that for the first 2.5 years of his professional career, he raced clean. But one day, a grueling ride in southern Spain had taken everything out of him. Lying exhausted on his hotel bed, a team doctor offered him something.
Yeah, one of them came in to check on me. You know, he was concerned and sympathetic, almost fatherly. He was wearing the fly fishing vest and pulled out a little red egg-shaped capsule. And there it was. You know, it was a pill of testosterone.
Hamilton swallowed it, and everything changed.
Within a couple of years, I was up to my neck in doping.
He began taking a synthetic form of a hormone that stimulates the creation of more red blood cells. More red blood cells means more oxygen in the blood, more endurance. Athletes refer to the drug by its shortened name, EPO.
Edgar Allan Poe, as we called it. You were able to train harder, longer, in a race like the Tour de France. Absolute game changer.
Now, you have to understand, this whole time, he's passing doping tests. But eventually, the tests for EPO became more thorough.
When we heard that, the doctors came up with a new plan, blood doping.
A new plan for them, but an old technique. Blood doping involves athletes taking their blood or someone else's blood, storing it, then re-injecting it during an event, again providing a boost of red blood cells, great for endurance sports. Hamilton says U.S. Postal had their own blood doping doctor. 10 days into the 2000 Tour de France, they met the doctor in a hotel room.
He'd put one of those big extraction needles into your arm and fill you back up, so to speak. And typically it would be about 450 cc's of blood.
Almost a half liter. During the 2004 Tour de France, Hamilton accidentally reinfused bad blood, basically giving himself blood poisoning. He had a horrendous fever and his urine turned black. But there was pressure to win and money at stake.
A physical and mental delivery here by Lance Armstrong to all of his rivals in the Tour de France. He is just going faster and faster and faster.
You know, we won the Tour in 99 with Lance, and it was a huge story. I mean, it was the worldwide story. We created a monster, and then it was like pressure just got bigger and bigger.
It caught up with him, and in 2004, he tested positive. Hamilton was suspended for 2 years and blacklisted from the sport. In 2010, the U.S. government opened a grand jury investigation into Armstrong and the U.S. Postal Team. Witnesses were subpoenaed, including Hamilton, who spent hours on the stand confessing to everything.
As soon as I started to tell the truth, I realized that I'd been protecting this culture for the better part of 14 years, and I realized, like, that culture was no longer worth protecting.
Former professional cyclist Tyler Hamilton. Back at the UCLA Olympic Analytical Lab, they're racing to keep up with the cheaters. It never stops. New samples arrive all the time. The latest shipment of boxes comes in, glass bottles of urine samples from around the world. As the boxes pass through the building, every set of hands they pass through are logged. Like police evidence, maintaining the chain of custody is essential for security. The samples get wheeled back to the lab where scientists store them in giant refrigerators. Dr. Anthony Butch pulls out one of the glass bottles, ready to be entered into the system. The bottles are at the extreme end of tamper-proof. They can only be opened by crushing the lid, and that requires a special machine. Here, they're using the latest techniques to detect drugs like EPO and practices like blood doping. Still, just as athletes like Armstrong and Hamilton were able to keep ahead of the tests for so long, Dr. Butch says it's only a matter of time before something new comes along. It can be hard to have a sense if they're winning the war or not.
Are you an optimist or a pessimist? If you're a pessimist, you probably believe everybody's doping and nobody's getting caught because the positive rate's very, very low. If you're an optimist, you think that very few people are doping and we're catching them all. Well, I'm kind of somewhere in between. I think we're catching some of them, but some of them are using compounds that are escaping our ability to catch them at this particular point.
He says every new drug that comes on the scene requires developing a new test, giving athletes who dope a window of opportunity.
We're getting closer to them. As they change their doping patterns, we can detect lower concentrations. I think we're picking up more cheaters. The problem is with new compounds as they come out, things that are extremely difficult to pick up, even if you have the technology.
Like drugs that stimulate the athlete's own pituitary gland to produce more growth hormone.
And these have a very, very short half-life, on the order of minutes.
Making the drug almost impossible to detect.
The testing is out there, it's just the window of detection becomes smaller. So they're getting much more sophisticated.
It's a constant arms race.
That's reporter Warren Cornwall. He's written a lot about the science of doping. At the level of the fan, why should we care about this?
If you take away restrictions on doping, essentially a sport becomes a battle between who has the best chemists and biologists to prevail. And that takes a heart out of it. I know personally for me, I mean, I'm a cyclist and a triathlete, and I have videotapes of just about all the Tours de France that Armstrong won, just for motivation. But I don't really watch them anymore.
Cornwall has found a reason for optimism, a scientist who's developing the ultimate weapon to end the doping wars. Instead of looking for drugs like EPO in the blood, he's looking for the footprints they leave behind at the molecular level. His name is Yannis Pitsilatis, a professor of sport and exercise science at the University of Brighton. With his research, supported by the World Anti-Doping Agency, Pitsilatis looks at the evidence of doping in the genetic sequence of RNA, the partner of DNA.
It's almost at the highest level of sensitivity, because what we are looking at is the switching on and the switching off of genes as a result of taking a particular drug. You develop this profile or signature of a particular drug, and then that's what you try and find.
So at this genetic level, there's a molecular footprint left behind?
That's the idea, yes. We can find consistently in everyone we have tested up until now, we find the same molecular signature to the same drug.
So how do you learn to recognize what the signature of a particular drug is at this genetic level?
Okay, so what we've done up until now is we've actually taken volunteers, healthy volunteers, who are athletes typically, who are not permitted to actually compete during the trial, because obviously they'd have an unfair advantage because they take a banned drug.
You're having them dope.
Well, I wouldn't use the word dope here, because they're basically agreeing to do this, but they're taking the same kind of drug that athletes in the past and now may be taking, but under control conditions. So we administer the drugs. So we're present when the drug is being injected, and then go into the laboratory subsequent to that and look at the genes that are being expressed. And doing that, we've identified these molecular signatures of, in this particular case, the drug EPO, erythropoietin.
With this test, how long are you able to trace the effects of the drugs?
So far, we've achieved a four-week identification, which is fabulous. The current detection window is typically 48 hours after taking an injection of EPO. 4 weeks is an incredible improvement compared to what we had up until now.
In terms of things that could generate false positives, are there things that you might misidentify as a signature for one of these drugs that's actually from something else?
Yes, and the most important one is going to altitude, especially middle and long distance athletes or endurance athletes will spend a significant amount of time, often living for prolonged periods of time and training at high altitude. And the changes which occur when you go to altitude, for example, increase in red blood cells so you can carry more oxygen, these are the same kind of effects the drug that they tend to take also produces. So we've got to make sure that going to altitude, while still has a similar effect on the red blood cells, isn't having the same molecular response. My prediction, based on the work that we've done to date, is that none of these confounders will have anywhere near the same kind of molecular signature as the particular drug of interest.
You're testing with your subjects with already existing substances that we know about. Say, though, in 6 months, something else comes on the market, there's some new molecular footprint. You have to spend the time learning that new signature, right?
Absolutely. Athletes that are currently doping should actually be having sleepless nights, because the bottom line is those samples that you collected for anti-doping purposes are being stored. So we can go back to those samples, apply these molecular signatures as we've developed them, and be able to identify them even years after they've done this. So the beauty of this kind of approach, this kind of molecular signature approach, is that it's almost uncheatable, in the sense that there are so many genes that are being switched on that if you wanted to manipulate the test, you couldn't do it, because just far too many genes to try and manipulate. And if you ended up trying to do that, you'll probably end up killing yourself.
Yannis Pitsilotis, professor at the University of Brighton. Warren Cornwall says a test like this, where RNA sequences could be examined months or years after the fact for previously unknown drugs, could finally give authorities a decisive edge in the doping arms race. Dr. Pitsilotis says that if everything goes as planned, his test will be ready in a year and a half. Early in his first term, 5 years ago, President Obama announced the implementation of the post-9/11 Veterans Educational Assistance Act.
The first GI Bill helped build a post-war economy that has been transformed by revolutions in communication and technology. And that's why the post-9/11 GI Bill must give today's veterans the skills and training they need to fill the jobs of tomorrow.
The federal government has spent more than $30 billion on that training since 2009, according to the Veterans Administration. But still, the unemployment rate among vets is higher than the national average. Veterans emerge from their service with high-level skills, but it's often not easy to turn those skills into credentials for a civilian job. That's our cover story today. Believe it or not, no one was even tracking graduation rates for veterans using GI Bill money, let alone more detailed information, until this year.
It was a surprise when I first started how little we know of student veterans and their accomplishments.
Chris Cate is the author of the first real-time study of how well the GI Bill works.
This is the first time that we've been able to properly identify both student veterans and be able to match them up with academic outcomes.
The study has been criticized for not incorporating enough data from for-profit institutions, but for now, it's the only study we have. Cate is establishing a baseline.
About 52.1% of our sample graduated with some type of degree that's anywhere from a certificate to a doctorate.
That's notably higher than the typical civilian graduation rate, which is less than half. The study found business, firefighting and security, and healthcare were the most popular fields. Derek Bennett is the chief of staff of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
Amongst our veterans who have gone back to school for both bachelor's and master's degrees, by almost fully 50%, they're pursuing business degrees. I think that's because it's the most utilitarian. Firefighting, security work, those are the kinds of things that can transfer directly from the military experience that you bring to bear. And it also is another way of giving back to the community. What we find amongst veterans is that's a major theme. They want to continue to build and give back to the community.
But the transition to civilian life is not easy. Leaving aside the huge issue of the psychological transition, vets often require a lot of schooling to re-enter the civilian workforce.
Some of the challenges that folks have with specific skill sets in translation are often digital and cyber warfare folks who may have extensive knowledge of how to best build IT infrastructures, et cetera, but might not have the exact certifications in, you know, Microsoft server systems or Salesforce, and so therefore have a difficulty translating that. One of the things that's troubling across the nation, though, are folks who are not trying to switch functions. So a combat medic who wants to be an EMT often has difficulty getting the proper accreditation from municipalities because you performed, you know, medical trauma response on the battlefield, that often doesn't mean you're qualified to go work in Dallas as an EMT.
So my name is Eric Strand. I was in the military for about 14 years, did 3 deployments to Iraq during that time.
Eric says he was a high school dropout with few prospects when he joined the Army in 1999. But he got into the Special Forces and became a medic.
I personally, as a medic, didn't see much until I went to Baghdad in 2005. We were in a small camp kind of in the middle of Baghdad, and people would often bring their casualties to us because there was no other safe haven in the middle of the kind of congested areas of the city. So I would see quite a few patients that had been injured by explosives, pretty much any way you can imagine somebody being injured by a bomb.
Eric became an expert in treating combat injuries. Still, he wasn't sure he was up for the day-to-day demands of being a doctor.
Around my third trip to Iraq, I was kind of getting burnt out on being available to people all the time. You know, I had teammates knocking on the door in the middle of the night every time they had heartburn, and I was starting to feel like maybe I didn't have the personality to be a full-time medical practitioner. Then there was one night where there was a big firefight, and one of my good friends, Jason Brown, was killed, and the other medic on the team was wounded that day, and he was somebody I really respected and looked up to as a professional. He was the kind of medic I wanted to be. So there's about 8 people wounded total that day, and we had to wait for about 2 hours before the helicopters would fly in. So obviously dealing with a whole lot of injuries on my own in a situation without a lot of help. So fast forward a few months, we went to Arlington to visit Jason's grave and then went to visit Mike while he was at Walter Reed. And he just said some really encouraging things to me about, you know, hey, I'm really glad it was you that day, and I think you did a wonderful job. And that was kind of the day I decided, you know, maybe I can do this medicine thing. And I started exploring how I was going to actually get into medical school, which is pretty daunting if you're active duty military.
Eric asked to be reassigned to Fort Bragg, where he could train young medics while he finished his undergrad classes at the University of North Carolina.
And at the same time, they were just starting up a program at UNC where the Special Forces medic instructors were working at the Burn Center. And we started getting mentorship in professional medicine and learning, you know, how to go through the application process, learning how to kind of integrate ourselves into medical and academic culture.
With the help of that and another UNC program specifically for veterans, Eric finished his undergrad degree, got a killer score on his MCAT, and is just a couple of weeks away from finishing his first year of medical school. He says there's a lot to adjust to when it comes to non-combat medicine.
You know, Special Forces training is a mile wide and inch deep. We have to learn a little about a lot. So kind of diving into the depth of what's there, you start really appreciating how wonderful and beautiful the human organism is.
Eric Strand represents the dream. He enters the Army as a high school dropout and leaves on track to become a doctor. But what about the people he served with? He says some have been able to find government or security contracting jobs, but for many, it has been a struggle.
Unfortunately, a lot of people do feel like they're kind of shortchanged when it comes to their experiences and trying to get some sort of credentialing or credit for it. And that's kind of the ongoing struggle of veterans to say, you know, I've invested this entire large period of my life into this career, and now I don't have a whole lot to show for it that I can put on paper.
Derek Bennett of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America worries that many veterans might end up taking jobs well below their skill levels.
A question that no one's been able to answer yet is, are the, you know, jobs that veterans are getting, are they appropriate? Is there an issue of underemployment? Which is to say, you know, it's one thing to get a job as an investment banker at JP Morgan Chase. It's quite a different thing to get a job as a greeter at Walmart.
Researchers like Chris Cate are starting to gather the data that will help determine how much the government's investment in education is paying off in actual jobs for veterans. But veterans groups say there's no time to lose. As troops continue to withdraw from Afghanistan, applicants for GI Bill money will increase. And in today's budget environment, it will be difficult to ask for billions more if there's no evidence the program really works. Now to Uganda, where to be openly gay can mean living in fear for your life. This February, Uganda's president signed the Anti-Homosexuality Act. First-time offenders of the law can face 14 years in prison. People found guilty of what the law calls aggravated homosexuality can be sentenced to prison for life. And beyond the law, violent attacks on LGBT people, or even those thought to be gay, tend to go unpunished. John Abdallah Wambere is directly affected by the law and surrounding anti-gay sentiment. He's an openly gay man and a prominent activist with the gay rights group Spectrum Uganda. Shortly before the law was signed, John traveled to the U.S. for his work. This past week, John announced that he was applying for asylum in the United States. I spoke to John a few days after he announced his decision, and he told me that after years of threats, attacks, and violence against LGBT Ugandans, it is now simply too dangerous to return home.
When I came to the U.S., I didn't have any intention of seeking asylum. I was coming to do my usual work, lobby, advocate, and fundraise for my organization, Spectrum Uganda. And 3 days later, the bill was signed. This made it very difficult for me to think how, if I went back, I would be at risk. And I just imagined what it would mean if I was on ground, being someone who has been so much on the forefront. Through all this, I kept pondering, what could I do? And I noticed that I would still be able to support my people back home while I'm in a much more safe environment.
And how is it you're going to be supporting them from overseas?
We're still doing the conversation with different partners, and whatever is being fundraised is being channeled back home. The need, actually, the major need is to ensure that people can still be facilitated to access medical services through a safe environment, and also to ensure that we have emergency money in terms of supporting court cases. And all this can be supported through financial support.
You know, following events from the outside, it seems that over the years, the situation for LGBT people in Uganda, it's just been getting worse and worse. Is that the case? And the fact that you've had to now seek asylum, is that a sign that it's the worst that it's been?
Yeah, it is a sign that it has got to us, because it reached an extent where you weren't even guaranteed of your own security, where you wouldn't even trust the next person. The fact that you cannot be able to know what your neighbor is thinking, this has put a lot of people in danger, where police has swung into action, storming people's houses and picking them out of the houses. There is a lot of blackmail and extortion going on with the police. A couple of people have been undressed in public just to ensure or to prove, are you a woman or a man? I mean, situations where people are being degraded and humiliated, being paraded before the media, and all these hate speeches and all the negative report that has come out in the media.
John, what family did you have to leave behind?
I have my relatives, actually, my nephews, whom I've been taking care of. There are 7 children in total, my late brother's kids, and my own biological daughter, who is 16 years, and a few who were my dependents also.
Were you able to discuss your decision with them?
A few of them, but I haven't discussed this with my immediate family, apart from one, and I told him not to actually reveal it. My daughter doesn't know that I'm not going back. My nephews, I mean, they write me emails and they're like, uncle, when are you coming back? Mm. And I have to tell them that I still have a couple of things I'm doing. It breaks me because I'm still holding this from them, because I can't know how they'll feel. Just yesterday, one of my very own friends, actually my staff at work, broke down and told me that his so disappointed, and he can't imagine. He's so stressed that I'm not going back. And I asked him what he felt like, and he's like, it's so bad. We were just imagining your presence, how strong you have been there for us. A lot of people are going to miss you. And I mean, messages that make you feel broken. But again, you have to stand firm, because it is something that is a journey right now.
To get asylum, what do you have to prove? What do you have to do to make your case?
The attorneys are holding that. I've just given them my story. And what I know is the truth.
And if it's not approved, if you're not granted asylum in the U.S., what will you do?
I have nowhere to go. Home is not safe, and it's not even a place I would want to think about.
John, thank you so much for speaking with us. Really appreciate you sharing your story.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
John Abdullah Wambere is a gay rights activist from Uganda. He is currently awaiting a decision about whether the U.S. will grant him asylum or if he will have to leave the country. When the hip-hop duo Atmosphere got their start back in the mid-90s, mainstream rap was dominated by a harder, aggressive sound. Think Dr. Dre or Notorious B.I.G. By contrast, with their spare production and tight, introspective lyrics, Atmosphere was something different.
It's the caffeine, the nicotine, the milligrams of tar. It's my habitat. It needs to be cleaned. It's my car, it's the fast talk they use to abuse and feed my brain. It's the cat box, it needs to be changed. It's
almost 20 years later, the duo, Sean Daly, a.k.a. Slug, the lyricist and MC, and producer Anthony Davis, a.k.a. Ant, have just released their seventh album. It's called Southsiders. The pair were in Los Angeles earlier this week for a show, so Sean Daly stopped by our studios in Culver City. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Hey. Hello.
Let's talk about the new album. It's called Southsiders, referring to the south side of Minneapolis. Let's hear a little bit of the title track.
Whole south side being up in your guts. Don't know how to describe how much you suck. And it's not just you, but every one of your plus. Follow each other around like a bunch of ducks. Just turn the music up and get dumb. Stretch your skin around the biggest drum. Born from a neighborhood of click and run. And already gave away my last stick of gum.
You know, I come from a school of thought where you are supposed to represent where you're from inside of your music. And we've always tried to do that. But to me, Southsiders meant a lot more than just where we're from. But
What else does it represent?
Well, everything has a South Side. You know, we make music that celebrates things, celebrates life and hope and love. But also, we also make music that celebrates the South Side of those things. What's on the other side of love? What's on the other side of hope? You know, and I felt like a lot of the writing on this record was my observations, you know, and things that I thought about over the last few years. And me and Anthony are both at places where we kind of love our lives right now, but I did want to still explore what the South Side of that meant.
Well, one of the things that's satisfying about this new record is that they're still very introspective songs. But you are wrestling now with certain things about aging, about growing up. Let's hear a little bit of that. This is from Fortunate.
You know I want to feel special. Walk around the festival carrying a big stuffed animal. I'm trying not to make a mess though. Gotta stay sensible. Ain't nobody coming with the antidote. I want to watch you grow. And I want to leave the planet better off than it was handed to me. And I don't know there's a possibility. So I settle for selling my soul to the slaves of the land of the free. I don't want to leave my family tree behind. I don't want no one to miss me like I miss you.
You know, I want to say if that's the clip that you guys play, that is possibly my favorite clip on the whole album. Is that, and to answer your question, yeah, you know, I always thought that when the day came that I would be afraid of death, that it was going to be this level of like facing this, I don't know, personified concept of death and having to struggle and I don't want to go yet. And I didn't realize what it really was. Like, I'm not scared to die. I've kind of reconciled that part. It's like, well, when you die, it's just done. There's no worry about it, what's going to happen afterwards. My fear of death stems from I'm afraid of what I leave behind for the people that are stuck organizing my record collection and figuring out what to throw away, or the mess that I've left in the basement or in the garage. You know, all of that, you know, the pain and maybe the lack of security that I leave behind, you know, that's where...
It's a perspective of a father?
I think it's a perspective of a father or a husband or just somebody who has surrounded himself with people that care about me and people that I love, you know?
We're not lucky, but we're fortunate. I'm pretty sure of it. And all the life we wasted trying to make some bread might have been better spent trying to raise the dead.
First single from the album is called Kanye West. Let's hear a little bit of that.
She says she wants someone to treat her as an equal. And right then we started speeding towards Reno. Burning rubber in a burgundy regal. Fly like a dove, then dive like an eagle. I'm a 70 deuce. That year was a classic. Buzz got loose and we here trying to catch it. She said that she was unimpressed. That's when I stood up and did the Kanye West. Put your hands in the air like you really do care.
That this my song is it's about how passion can sometimes be viewed as this negative thing. Love can make you do crazy things. Love can make you snap out and overreact. And so this song was kind of about some of the overreacting that occurred during the courtship of my wife. And I named it after Kanye West just because I feel like he kind of personifies that concept. He's very passionate about his art. He's very passionate about what he's trying to accomplish. And I always find it interesting when people want to criticize somebody for having feelings, because you can't tell me my feelings are incorrect. You can tell me you don't agree, you can tell me you don't understand, you don't relate, but I think when you look at a lot of our superstars, a lot of these people are scared to step on each other's toes. I feel like Kanye is one who's not, and I think that we could use more of that. And so I feel him when he has an outburst. But not so much because I can relate to what he's outbursting, because I don't have a life like his, but just because I can relate to loving something so much that you really don't care what the people perceive or how they judge you for that love.
Put your hands in the air like you really do care. Do care. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
38th Street Station.
I want to talk about Rhymesayers, the label you founded back in the 90s with other independent hip-hop artists in Minneapolis. What motivated you to start that label?
It was out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from Minneapolis, we had no hopes of ever... You know, I never even mailed a demo to some A&R guy in New York or Los Angeles. I never even bothered to play the game because I already felt like the cards were stacked against me. So when I had my first son, I was 21, and that's when I quit rap. That's when I quit and lost all of my desires to be this rap superstar. And I decided I'm going to go into the workforce and just go get a real job that offers some benefits so that I can afford to take care of my new family, you know?
When you try to be conventional, what did you do? What was your job?
I went and got a job as a courier for a wholesale florist. And my goal was to get in as a driver, because I love driving, and to work my way up into a sales position where I'm bringing in $50,000 a year or something, you know what I mean? Like, but with benefits, and get a house, a little house, a little nice place somewhere in South Minneapolis, you know? And when I made that decision, that's when people started paying attention to my rapping. And that's when we started the record label. That's when we started putting out tapes, CDs. And I don't think we ever really could have foreseen where it was going to go. You know, as a kid, yes, I wanted to be LL Cool J, and I wanted to have gold necklaces and be in the back of a limousine with models and stuff. But by the time I became an adult, I had no intentions of any of that. And truthfully, I'm so glad I didn't end up being LL Cool J in the back of a limousine with models and stuff. Like, the way it worked out, I couldn't have asked for a better, more perfect story. You know?
Sean Daly, real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Sean Daly is the MC for the hip-hop duo Atmosphere. Their new album, Southsiders, is out now.
You gotta write your way through.
It's been said that comedy is tragedy plus time. It seems that's true across the world.
As a black guy, we do kind of blame apartheid a lot. You know, you have a guy with a headache, you'd be like, hey, what's wrong? I think it's apartheid.
That's Kagiso Ladiga performing in South Africa. He's one of several comedians featured in the documentary Stand Up Planet. L.A.-based comic Hassan Minhaj is our on-screen guide to the stand-up planet. He takes us around the world to find comedians confronting very serious issues with comedy.
There's all sorts of terrible things that happen around the world, and comedy is one of those few things where you can discuss those things.
As Minhaj told me, the goal of this project was to follow the jokes into people's lives.
To show that a comedian on stage in India talking about sanitation or in South Africa talking about HIV and AIDS awareness, if you follow the joke into their lives, you can see that, like, oh, these things aren't just contrived in joke books. This is real life. I think the best comedians have that bravery and courage to say, oh, this is what it is. This is unfair. That's not cool. And everybody in that moment, collectively, the crowd is like, yes.
Let's start off with the first stop on your trip, which is India. And I think a lot of people have this idea of India, it's a big democracy, so there must be free speech.
Right.
Not so much.
Not so much. I met two amazing comedians, one named Tanmay Bhatt and the other was Aditi Mittal. And Tanmay has one of the most popular podcasts in India.
So what are we discussing on today's episode? Tarun Tejpal, he's in custody right now for 14 days.
It's not even like it was like very lewd or crass. It was controversial in the sense of the institutions that it was mocking and the institutions that it was criticizing that it got pulled off of iTunes India. That didn't stop them. They uploaded it to SoundCloud and to other third-party upload sites where people could still get that content. And that was really cool to see that.
Now, you were, I thought this was pretty brave of you. You decided to perform there.
Yeah.
We have a little clip of your performance.
I got off the plane. They said, hey, there's a guy. His name is Raj. He'll pick you up. I'm in f-ing India, man. How many Rajas are there? I come out. There's 97 brown dudes. Sir, sir, sir. Don't. I can't. I'm going to believe all of you.
True story.
Yeah, but they
True story. They
seem to go for it.
Yeah, man. Dude, when I took the stage, man, I'm not going to lie. Like, I was just shaking. You know, growing up in the States, there's this part of me that's like, man, I'm Indian. Like, this is where I belong. And as soon as I got to India and I had to go to the bathroom in some places, I was like, man, I am American.
Boy, do I know what you're talking about.
Bring me to Jamba Juice. I love air conditioning and Starbucks. And I would check myself. I was like, Hassan, you are going to the bathroom in this hole. You are doing it. Man up.
So you decided to, you were going to bring a comic from each of the countries you visit. With India, you went with Aditi Mittal.
Aditi Mittal.
Tell us about her.
Aditi is a comedy superstar over in India. She's only one of three female English-speaking comedians in India.
You know, the vaginal beautification industry. They want our vaginas to be fairer. They want our vaginas to be tighter. I'm like, how about we do that for our women's laws?
Aditi might get mad if she hears this. She doesn't like it when I call her a female comedian. She's like, that you're a dude comedian. They don't call you penile comedian. Like, don't call me that. And the work that she's doing is transcending gender and race, and it's making people think about gender roles in India and stuff like that.
And the comedian that you brought from South Africa,
Umpho Pops,
he grew up in Soweto.
Africa as a whole, we have a big HIV/AIDS problem, right? And I believe that one of the roots of this problem is that we're not honest with each other. Like, if a woman could come up to you in the beginning of a date and say, yo, hope you got those condoms, right? If you could be honest in the beginning, we'd be better prepared.
HIV and AIDS in South Africa is one of those issues where everybody has a loved one or someone that they know that's had to hide it. And he's talking about something really, really painful, but he's making it so funny.
So you bring these two comedians. You bring Aditi and Umpho here to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And they get to perform at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
How'd they do?
You know what, man? They did great. Everybody at the show, they loved them.
As an Indian traveling abroad, sometimes, actually most of the time, you'll meet this one person who's like, so tell me, like, for real, when did you learn how to speak English? So now I could tell her that, you know, India has been under colonial rule for the past 200 years, and that's why our entire private education system is based in English. But I'm like, you know, on the flight.
They're funny.
They're funny. They're good definitely comics. Funny. Yeah. Oh, they're really funny.
Like I thought skating on thin ice was a compliment for years. My mom would be like, "So how's school going?" I'd say, "Hey, mama, they say I'm ice skating."
Son, you're a comedian, so you're as skeptical and ironic and all those things as you can get.
Sure.
Were you surprised by how this film, by the end, it's pretty earnest? I mean, there's kind of an unironic, earnest sweetness about the power of comedy by the end of this.
Yeah. One of the biggest difficulties that I think the way comedy is represented on screen is it's either just all fart jokes, you know, and it's just laughter for the sake of laughter, or it's one of those things where it's just kind of very preachy, very heavy-handed. I think this project was one of the few things that I've done in my career where it bridges that gap, and we dance in both circles.
Issam Minhaj, great pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, man.
Stand Up Planet premieres this Wednesday nationally on Pivot and Link TV, and in Southern California on KCET. It'll be up on standupplanet.org after that. Thanks again for listening. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth, and this is the music of Rodrigo y Gabriela. They're a pair of former heavy metal guitarists who left Mexico for Ireland and developed an acoustic sound that's taken them from playing on the streets for change to some of the biggest stages on the festival circuit. Rodrigo y Gabriela's latest album is called Nine Dead Alive. Each track is dedicated to a different person, or in one case, dedicated to animals and nature. The piece you're listening to right now is for Fyodor Dostoevsky. Rodrigo Sanchez and Gabriela Quintero joined me at NPR West earlier this week to talk about these new songs.
We decided to pick 8 people, 4 male and 4 female figures. From history, that we think they're still alive among us. You know, their legacy is still among us through art, you know, literature, or we have some humanitarian people there. And we didn't want to pick the usual suspects.
They somehow improved humanity. So that's when you think about these people or their work, you think there is still hope for many things, you know.
People like Viktor Frankl, who developed a philosophy of finding hope after something like the Holocaust,
yes.
and Harriet Tubman, of course, of the Underground Railroad. But there are more obscure figures as well, like Fridtjof Nansen. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, he was very important. He liberated almost 400,000 war prisoners. He was a very well-known figure in Norway, but he was involved in politics without really wanting. After he was, appointed the first ambassador in England from Norway.
And I should say the title of that track is Fram.
Fram, which is basically a boat that he, because he was an explorer as well.
It's a boat, but it means forward. I think that's the meaning of the word.
He didn't reach the North Pole, but he opened the whole bridge, you know, to go there. And he built this boat, which is amazing, and he kind of changed the whole perspective and techniques to sail, you know, to go and to break the ice and all that.
Let's talk about the Animals and Nature track, Torito. How did Animals and Nature affect the writing there?
There's no better humanity without us reconnecting with the animal world and the natural world. And I know it sounds super hippie and all these things, but I think it's important to kind of, for me anyway, to just share it like that, you know?
Do you ever take your guitar out in nature and just play outside?
Well, I live in Zihuatanejo, which is a part of Mexico that is... You know, at the end of the film, Shawshank Redemption, Morgan Freeman goes to Zihuatanejo because it's a paradise place. And it's not a mythological or it's not an invention.
Although
it's an actual...
It's not the actual place where he...
Yeah, but a lot of people...
It's probably Vancouver.
But a lot of people go to Zihuatanejo because of that film. And that's where I live. So nature is never out of tune, you know?
Well, you have your guitars with you, and yeah. I know you have a song I think you're ready to play about a famous guitar maker, right?
Yes, of course.
It's called Soundmaker, and it's dedicated to the individual who gave us the modern guitar.
Yes, the classical guitar looking, which is the one we kind of play now.
Great. Yeah, let's hear this.
Yeah.
That was great. It's really it's hard for me because I have to be quiet over here. I want to make noises. It's hard for me not to grunt and make sounds when you guys are jamming like that. It's great.
Thanks.
That's Rodrigo y Gabriela with the in-studio performance of The Soundmaker from their new album, Nine Dead Alive. Gabriela, you take rhythm guitar very seriously. You're getting some serious percussion out of your guitar, though. You're smacking it and slapping it in different ways. What's that technique?
This technique is, well, I don't know what it is, honestly, but at the beginning I tried to play like a flamenco guy, but I couldn't pick those rhythms. And then living in Ireland as well, I met a lot of Irish musicians. They play the Irish drum that is called Baron, that is played with mm-hmm. a stick, and that goes more with my technique. And when I saw a couple of Baron players, they're amazing over there, I thought, well, I can do that with a hand. My guitar playing and percussion parts, it goes more with Irish music than flamenco music. Yeah. I don't know. So, for instance, all this, you know, like,
that's Rodrigo y Gabriela. Their new album is called Nine Dead Alive. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for inviting us.
So, could you do one more song?
Yes.
Can I make a request?
I like
Misty Moses, the Harriet Tubman song.
Okay.
What do you think?
Okay, let's try.
I'll try to be quiet over here while you play.
Let's try that.
For the week ending May 11th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, and Daniel Hajek. Patrick Murray is our technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.